I had a rant planned for this one. I'll try to fit into 1 minute.
If it's 2 minutes, it's fine, Jan.
You can cut out some of my bird stories.
No, those are essential. I've already created a section in the show notes for birds we mentioned.
If only we could take our love of reading to a new level.
Well, I've always wanted to start a book club.
Book club!
For masochists and other deviants.
Hello and welcome to the Book Club for Masochists, where we read and discuss all the genres and types of literature, regardless of our actual interest in them.
Every month, we read books from a new, randomly picked genre. Then on the podcast, we discuss our reading choices, experiences, opinions, appeal factors, and other related topics as friends and library workers.
This is episode number 193, and it is time for our quarterly update on what kind of media we like and are spending our time with outside of the podcast.
Our thirdly?
I guess so.
There's no other way. We only do these three times.
Three times.
But we do like an end of year wrap up. Doesn't that count?
No, but that's one of the three.
Oh, so tertiary.
Well, yeah, we've always only ever done three of these a year.
Try regular.
Yes, every 4 months. Like clockwork. The clock that goes every 4 months. There's just 1, 2, and 3 on the clock.
Trimesters. Is that something?
Or trimesterly? That doesn't sound right.
It's too closely associated with pregnancy for us to use that one.
I know. Definitely. Yeah.
No, I think tertiary is like incidental or like minor. Anyway.
Who are we?
Good question. My name is Jam. I'm a librarian in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Stolo people.
My name is Matthew. I'm a librarian in Fort Collins, Colorado, USA.
My name is Anna. I'm also a librarian in Fort Collins, Colorado, USA, which is located on the traditional and ancestral homelands of the Arapaho, Cheyenne, and Ute nations and peoples.
My name is Megan. I am an archivist. I live and work on the unceded traditional territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe, which is also known as the National Capital Region of Canada.
Announcements! Number one, join our Discord server. We have a Discord server.
Thanks for reminding me. I haven't joined yet.
You're free to talk about the podcast or other things as well. It's, yes.
Like most places.
Indeed. It's not only talk about podcast all the time. Announcement number two, we will be presenting at the Ontario Library Association RA in a Day, which is coming up at the end of this month, I believe. I can't remember the exact date.
April 30th.
So we're presenting at that. They keep asking us back. For some reason. And announcement number three is that we have a book list for this episode, a retroactive book list, a genre that we covered on the podcast before we started making book lists for all of the genres.
Yes. And that is a book list of titles by BIPOC authors, Black, Indigenous, and People of Color authors. And the retrospective genre for this book list is political thrillers. So check the show notes of this episode for a list of political thrillers by BIPOC authors.
I wish that we had this list when we did this genre originally, because I feel I would have enjoyed one of these books more than the one I actually read.
Yeah, that's fair.
I guess in some ways, I will be talking about a political thriller by a BIPOC author on this episode for a genre of media I've enjoyed recently.
Mm.
And that is Spy X Family by Tatsuya Endo, which is a manga series and now an anime, and there's a movie and there's novels and everything. It's a whole media empire at this point.
Figurines. We ran into a bunch of those in Alaska at the comic shop in my hometown.
Tons of toys. Also, a lot of fan art of the little girl Anya hanging out with Yatsuba from the Yatsuba. And
yeah, that makes sense.
So Spy X Family is, I call it a political thriller, but it's really more like a political thriller comedy series. It is about a spy who is undercover in a world, and it's kind of a like Cold War East versus West Germany sort of world. And he's undercover, and he's been told you have to infiltrate and get close to this important politician. And so you're going undercover, and you need to get a child and pretend to be the father of this child at this private school so that you can get close to the. You use your child to get close to the politician's child, and spy on them and things like that. So he is a, you know, like master of disguise, great spy and everything like that. And he has to go and find a child because he does not have a child. And so he goes and he goes to an orphanage and he finds a little girl who's a telepath. And so she can read his thoughts. And does exactly what he wants a child to do in order to get adopted. And she's like five or something, and so doesn't really understand everything that's going on. And at first he thinks that she's a genius, but she's really not at all because she's just a little girl. And then he has to go find a wife as well. And so he ends up in a marriage of convenience with a woman who is like, you know, basically an old maid because she's in her like late 20s or something and not married. And so she decides that she needs to marry somebody and they meet up and marriage of convenience. Anyway, she's also secretly an assassin and is going around killing people for like a shady assassin organization. And she does not know that her husband is a spy. He does not know that his wife is an assassin. Neither of them knows their child is a telepath. And then eventually they adopt a dog who can tell the future. And so it's very ridiculous in a lot of ways. But it's also so dramatic. Like, it's so well done. The art is fantastic. It just is really captures the action and the characters' body language and feelings and everything like that. It's like easy to read. You know, you're not never like wondering, oh, well, I don't really understand what happened here or anything. You know, the characters all have very distinct art, like styles. They wear, you know, multiple outfits and everything, which is something I really appreciate, though probably more so from having read too many superhero comics where the characters just dress the same all the time. But it's like, and you get a number of different types of stories in it. So like it's an ongoing thing, but you get the stories where they're like, oh, are they going to get into the fancy private school? Because the little girl has to take like the test and they have to go and like be a family in order to get accepted to this very fancy private school. Once he's accepted into the school, there's, you know, school stuff that goes on. She makes friends. She has other little children that she is like enemies with. So there's those plots. There's the one where the wife Yor is going off and doing assassin things while trying not to get caught by anybody else. It's just really well done. And I honestly read a number of volumes. It's up to volume 11 now, I think is the most recent one. So I read volumes 8, 9, and 10 over the last few months. And it's just such a well done series. It's like a Shonen Jump Plus series, I think, originally. So it is kind of theoretically aimed at like teenage boys, but I think it surpasses that some of the other stuff that's there and is enjoyable to anyone who enjoys like, you know, any sort of action comedy stuff. It's very good. It also had like in some of the most recent volumes something I didn't expect, which was like a really kind of like anti-war message, which I also appreciated from this sort of thing. So yeah, just a very well told and engaging story. I went back and read another comic by the same creator that was also nicely drawn, but did not hold together story wise. So interesting to see how a creator evolves throughout their career.
I have a manga I can talk about if we need a segue.
Go for it.
A manga that I have been enjoying recently is Quality Assurance in Another World by Masamichi Sato. And I've read the first several volumes. I wanted to talk about this one. It's not, I'd say, at this point, I think it is too early. I've only read like the first four or five volumes. And I'd say it's too early for me to know if this is going to be one that I will, you know, continue reading into volume, you know, 15, 16, whatever. But I mean, I mostly want to talk about it because it seems like so few people are reading it, and I don't understand why, because I find the concept really charming and some of the humor really charming, and the art is wonderful. And so I think more people should check it out. It has something like 12 reviews on Goodreads, which is so few in terms of, you know, manga series. So Quality Assurance in Another World is about a character in a fantasy world who, it is revealed very soon into the first volume, is actually a quality assurance tester who is trying out this like full virtual reality, massive multiplayer online RPG. You know, it's he's testing World of Warcraft, but like fully immersive virtual reality. And at some point, recently in the somewhat recent past, he and all of the other quality assurance testers got stuck in the game. Everyone is unable to log out, and so all of them are, you know, have real human bodies back in the real world, but are all basically living for an indeterminate amount of time in this virtual world. And most people have either figured out, I mean, yes, we meet many other characters who are also QA testers throughout the series, but many of them have like settled down in a spot, have many of them have become just sort of hedonists, have just gone like, you know, full goblin mode, just causing chaos and using their, you know, using god mode since they're QA testers and they can, you know, toggle on whether or not they can die and all that kind of thing. Using that to just do whatever they want, essentially. But our protagonist is very dedicated to the QA mission and figures that if he finishes his job, maybe that will let them log out. And so you have a main character in this fantasy world who's doing stuff like pressing himself against a wall and running back and forth to see if he'll glitch through. And, you know, it's just, it's very fun. I really like the chapter headings are all like loading screens that you would see in a game like, you know, Skyrim or Baldur's Gate or something like that, where there's like a little loading icon and then like a fun fact about the world, which I think is just such a cute, clever way to like tell the reader a little bit more about this world in this, you know, very appropriate for the genre way. And the dragons are really doofy. I know Matthew and I talked about this one, and it has the funniest dragons that I have ever seen. They're great. They're adorable. And I don't understand why more people have not tried the series. It's quality assurance in another world. Was there anything else about it I wanted to mention?
There is an anime coming out later this year.
Yes.
Which is sure to increase its popularity. So if you are a library that does not have this in your collection, now is the time to consider getting it, I think.
Absolutely.
But yeah, those dragons, incredible designs.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I really have a transition, but...
You don't have a book about derpy dragons?
No, I really genuinely don't. So I'm going to go with a very different thing, which is something of a location-specific one, but... Not totally, completely, maybe? I don't know. So Matthew and I, a couple weeks ago, took a long weekend and went to Denver to just get a little break. And on our first day down there, we went to Convergence Station, which is an interactive art installation space, basically, on the simplest description of it.
More emphasis on the installation art than the interactive art, I feel.
Oh, yeah,
there are elements of interactivity to it.
Yeah, there are some, but it's interactive in the fact that you are running through basically the entire building becomes an art installation and you are running around in it. It's one of several different installations like this that are across the USA in several different locations. So there's one in Grapevine, Texas. There's one in Denver that we went to. There's one in Santa Fe, New Mexico, one in Las Vegas, Nevada, which we never did go to despite being there. And there's a planned one for Houston, Texas that's not open yet.
Meow Wolf. This is called Meow Wolf. That's the larger branding.
Yeah. So that's the branding for it, or the company that organizes these. Each one has a different theme. So the one in Denver is called Convergence Station and has sort of a storyline that's going through it that has to do with a station that brings together four different worlds. And there's some sort of nefarious thing that is going on within this space. And it sort of has to do with like stealing memories and what they call memes. And you can run around and engage with that storyline, or you can truly just run through the space and just like see what kind of weird and interesting art installation stuff is going on.
You can also walk.
Or walk through the space. I will say it is not particularly accessibility friendly. A lot of the spaces are, there's some even uneven floors. There's a lot of stairs and not a huge amount of ability to get around certain the stairs in certain spaces to see everything. Cramped spaces, lots of people. Although they do keep it like time controlled in terms of entries.
We spent 4 hours there, I think.
About 4 hours there. They're pretty big. Each of these is pretty big. The one in Las Vegas is called a Mega Mart, and it's basically like themed off of like grocery store, but like very strange and like uncanny and sort of commentating on our modern world in ways. Which I think all of these are to a degree, is integrating that like art and commentary about our world and lives today, but in a way that you could either actually engage with the commentary or just run around and be like, weird. Everything's weird. My favorite aspect in terms of it's not something that like wildly blew me away, but you know what's really fun about it is I'm used to going to art museums or things like that, even installations, where you're kind of directed in a way. Like you have a path, you have structure that's really obvious to the space, right? And there's a certain amount of direction to how you work through a space that's suggested by how orderly it is. This is utterly not orderly. You almost per the structure of the space have to get lost. You're just going to be lost constantly in there. And it's fine. That's one of the things I enjoyed the most, was just letting go of any sense that I knew where in the world I was in this building and just wandering around slowly figuring out which of the four doorways into like every single room seems to have like 3 to 4 doorways, at least one of which is probably disguised and hard to find. and so like, which of these doors is going to take me where? How am I going to get back to a central point or an exit point, or how do we figure out how to connect backwards to get to a different one? Because we did do a little bit of following of the storyline stuff. So sometimes you needed to backtrack to go get information or interact with something that was in an earlier section. But yeah, you could engage with the storyline or not. It's not cheap to get into. We got a discount from being locals. I think it made it $35 for us with the local discount, but per person. So,
like $35 for 4 hours, like that's fine to me.
Yeah, that was fine. It goes up quite a bit if you're like non-local and it's the weekend. So definitely like day of the week changes the pricing. But the additional like little pass that lets you interact with the storyline is just $3. And you only need one per group. You don't really need an individual one. So you can either just go in there because you want to run around and see the space and you think it's interesting to engage with, or you can spend the extra $3 for whatever your group size is and get the little pass to interact with all the story engagement spaces.
It's like an RFID card thing that you tap on like certain things, and you get videos and stuff like that pop up.
So it was just different from any kind of like I haven't gone through an interactive space setup quite the same as that. And the fact that I feel like we could go back again and get new and different things out of it, but it probably isn't a thing that I would like I'm not going to go back regularly all the time because it's that engrossing. But I do find, I thought it was interesting. It was worth the visit. Be prepared for families with kids. There was a lot of them, which is fine. There's enough space in there and you can kind of move room to room. You don't have to, you never feel like you're tied into any particular space or experience within there. You just keep revolving through things and there's always something new and you can always revolve back over again to something and see it again or get a different view of it or whatever and take in different aspects about it.
What was your favorite part?
I mean, honestly, I really genuinely, I'm not kidding when I say like my favorite part was just the experience of like letting myself go to get lost in a space and being there's not that many times in modern life where you're just like, I'm going to go be lost. And that's great. Like you do that in the great outdoors sometimes, but that's what can be a little dangerous, right? So in this space, it's somewhat controlled, but not too much. And you just kind of get lost and don't have a particular direction or goal in mind. You're utterly goalless. You're just like wandering through experiencing it all. And it's nice to not have to feel like I need to be getting culturally educated by looking at art or something. I'm just being lost and taking it in. And, you know, the not knowing where I am or not knowing what time it is or not knowing what the purpose even of all of it is, it's all fine. It's all part of it. And that's kind of enjoyable.
It's also not trying to sell you stuff all the time. You know, like there's like a gift shop and everything, but the vast majority of it, like there's no way to buy what you're looking at.
Totally.
Which is cool.
Yeah. And there's no reason why you aren't directed in such a way that you have to walk through the gift shop. Like a lot of these do, you can utterly avoid the gift shop and never touch it. And you would not miss a thing of the rest of the experience pretty much.
My favorite part was the weird pizza place.
Yes. We did have that one room where the background of the room sort of changed when you waved around in it. And so that was the same as a room from something we did back in Seattle. And what was the?
Mopop.
Yeah, in the Mopop in Seattle. And so Matthew had a picture of me from there doing that. So he took another picture of me here doing that. And so that was sort of a nice convergence of experiences.
Yes, a convergence.
Convergence. Experiences. Anyways, I do wish I'd gone to see the Omega Mart one in Las Vegas while we were there, because I think I would find that an interesting take from this, you know, this company / group that's building these to see what they produce there. So I don't know. I got friends there. I might go visit sometime and maybe go see that.
Nice. I'm just looking at the website associated with this, and I have to say the gift shop stuff is kind of wild. So take a look if you're not close enough to go.
If you want to retroactively link yours to mine, Anna, mine was an isekai manga, and this sounds like a very isekai in real life experience.
Yeah, you're right. It does kind of.
It's being magicked away to a different world.
Yeah, it is. It's very much like it's being magicked away to a different world. So yes, I guess you could say it is isekai related via some very different actual tone to that, but it's still doing that. I mean, there's actually like when you go in, you can go up like staircases or things just to go in and enter whatever floor. It's like a multi-floor thing. Not that you can tell that when you're inside it. You actually can't tell what floor you're on most of the time, precisely. They're all kind of like melded together in weird ways. This is why the up and down and the accessibility is an issue, I think. But you can also take the elevator up. And so the first time we went up, we just avoided that because there was a big long line. And we just went up the stairs, but I had to go down at one point because I was just dying of thirst, and you can't have any food or water or anything in the spaces. So I went downstairs to get some water. And then when I came back up, I came up the elevator and I realized they have a whole like bringing you in to the story sort of experience that goes on around the elevator, where there's like the elevator crew is in character and like,
we took the stairs.
Yeah, we took the stairs.
You never told me this.
It's true. I'm sorry. But yes, there is they have a little like they're in character and they're sort of welcoming you to the space and telling like as if they are, you know, part of the Convergence station crew, like telling you are being you know, shuttled up to the Convergence station and here's what's happening and welcome kind of stuff.
That sounds super neat. I will link this to an experience. A couple of weeks ago, we went to go see a musician with an orchestral accompaniment. So the artist, the musician is Lisa LeBlanc, who is a New Brunswick, Acadian, folk rock, trash rock singer, who I discovered, I don't know, a couple years ago. And apparently, I was not aware of this, but it wasn't like, you know, she's a famous musician, and then they create an orchestral piece around famous musician. It was more like she came out with an album with this idea in her head that it was going to be like a symphonic experience. When she finally got to tour the album, because it came out in the middle of the pandemic, whatever. And so this, we went to see her in Ottawa. That was the last stop on her tour. And so, like it really, I hadn't seen her in performance before. I knew she, like, growing up as an artist, performed in a lot of bars and stuff, and that's sort of what I expected from the music, which has a lot of guitars and whatever, and is fun and rocky like that. But so we get into the auditorium, and we're like at the very back of the last row up at the top in the balcony. And so you can see like straight down onto the orchestra pit. You see all the orchestra getting ready, whatever. And they do their thing, the little intro thing as they're doing. And then, you know, the light show starts. And unfortunately, there was like one single light right at the back that shone straight into our face. Luckily, that did not last the whole show. And then Lisa LeBlanc shows up in like covered in sequins, basically. And it's like just the crowd is like flipping out. They are so happy to see a New Brunswick person, an Acadian, up in town, and everybody knows all the words to the song and everything like that. And so that's, I think, the first time I've been at a concert in several years now. And it was like the crowd, like emotional groupiness of the experience where everybody's like tapped and like, yeah, we're doing this thing and we're so happy. I don't have the words to like describe the fantasticness of the show and the sequence and the everything. I will link the album. It's called Chiac Disco. It's very Acadian and very awesome, even if you don't understand all the words.
Chiac is one of the regional
dialect.
Oh my gosh, the word disappeared from my mind. Yeah, Chiac is the regional dialect of French, or one of the regional dialects of French in New Brunswick. It's not standard Quebecois French.
No, don't like. That would be offensive, I think, to Acadians who have to deal with Quebecois coming in and calling them, oh, you're so cute, and you're a little Chiac, and you're French. It's like, step off. Yeah. I was first exposed to it because I spent some time around the University of Moncton in a French immersion program. For myself, as a person raised in Quebec, I was not aware that there were a large communities of Francophones outside of Quebec. So I was like, oh, well, that's good to know. I have been exposed to a wider world than I've been in. Anyway, delightful, awesome, great, experiential.
I will mention another comic. This is an older comic that has been reprinted last year in big fancy hardcovers. So this is Giant Days, written by John Allison and drawn by Max Sarin and Lisa Treyman. It is about three young women who are going off to college, university in the UK, and they just like hijinks is maybe the best. Hijinks ensue is kind of the best thing to come up with. They are very well drawn, and the stories, the author, John Allison, has their voices down so well. There's three, the three women are, one is a goth disaster person, I guess maybe is the best way to describe them. They have a drama field and they make everything more dramatic for everything around them. The other is like kind of a intense, like chain smoking person who I believe is in medical school. And the third one is a much more happy, outgoing person who is in archaeology. And they, I think they had been homeschooled up to this point, so they're not as exposed to the outside world. So it's really like they, you know, they date people, they break up with people, they get into, they deal with stuff in their courses, and other stuff. Like there's a multi-issue arc of them trying to find somewhere to live, like renting places, I think. But really, I think what I think is so amazing about the series for something that came out in the last decade is that every issue is a satisfying read. Like you might have arcs that go on for multiple issues, but like every issue tells basically a complete story, which is so unlike what most single issue comics are now. And so reading in a collection doesn't really matter, but you can just read one issue and put it down again. Like you don't have to feel like you need to read the entire book in one go. But it's just so funny and great. It makes me really happy to read it. It really cheers me up, to read about this stuff. And I recently learned that the artist Max Sarin who took over from issue 7, had never drawn a full comic before taking over the series. They were in school, and they got suggested as an artist, and they'd never finished a comic before. And then thrown completely into the deep end. And you can definitely see their art evolve over it. But I was like, oh my gosh, I can't imagine doing that. Suddenly you're drawing a monthly comic. And they said that it helped having the deadlines and being like, oh, you have to have this done by the end of the month, really helped them actually finish things, which I thought was funny. But yeah, it's great. I think also like the humor John Allison comes from webcomics, like so many of his comics are available online, and he is so good at basically making every page a readable thing. And so like there'll be like a joke or something on every single page, which is like, you know, I talk about like each issue being a satisfying read. Each page is often a satisfying read as well, which is kind of wild to consider. But he's been doing that since like the 90s doing webcomics. And so he is, he knows what he's doing in regards to this stuff. And I really enjoy his stuff. There's 7 hardcovers that collected. I can't remember how many original volumes there were, like 15 or something. 14, 13, 12, a bunch. So yeah, there's 7 hardcovers that collected all.
I don't have a segue. Are there any birds in Giant Days? I don't remember. I read it so long ago. I can also endorse.
Yeah, there's definitely birds. I believe one of the characters maybe adopts a pigeon.
Great.
At some point, like a baby pigeon that they find. That the name was on the tip of my brain for a second and then it went away again. But also like, I'm like, that sounds like a plot, but maybe I'm making it up, but.
I second Giant Days being great. Megan is thirding with a nod.
I think we've got all of us on board. So
we're behind this 10-year-old media recommendation.
I know. I have a little bit, cause I also have a 10-year-old one that I could talk about.
I could use the segue. I don't know if it's 10 years old, but this one is one that I am not necessarily enjoying recently. I'm just thinking about recently. And that is a board game called Wingspan. And I was thinking about things that I've enjoyed recently. And one of them was I took a trip and visited my family in Berlin. And we went to the zoo, which was great, and went to the zoo with a 2-year-old, had a great time. But one of my favorite parts was when the 2-year-old was napping and just all of the adults went like at our own pace through the bird exhibit. And the Berlin Zoo has a lot of birds. So I can't really recommend that experience necessarily. I guess we've already recommended a like single site experience that you have to travel to. I think for most of our listeners, Berlin is a further journey to make just to see the birds. I mean, go to your local zoo or bird sanctuary. I know here in Vancouver, there's the Bloedel Conservatory, which is awesome. It's like one of my go-to places to bring visitors. Hang out with birds. Birds are having a cultural moment. This is how I'm feeling. I don't know if you all agree. I feel like birds, like,
aren't real. Jam, birds aren't real.
Birds are very real. And we all are, I think, realizing birds, maybe just in our generation, just like people in their 30s are getting into bird watching. And maybe this has always been true. Maybe your 30s is just when you get into bird watching.
Quite possibly.
But I do feel like, yeah, more people than ever that I've known are into bird watching. And I feel like everyone knows a lot of bird fun facts right now. I just feel like birds as a category are having a sort of dinosaur moment, or, you know, like pirates 20 years ago.
Well, they are dinosaurs.
They are dinosaurs. Right. Yeah. That's what I mean. We're respecting them as such at the moment, I feel like.
Yeah, there you go.
Where adults are collecting birds the way that children collect dinosaurs. Not physically collecting, but, you know, collecting knowledge about them. Anyway, Wingspan's the actual recommendation. This is a board game that's all about birds. If you're looking for bird facts, there's a ton of bird facts in this board game. This is a board game I don't actually own. A friend of the show, Jessie, one of our previous hosts, owns it, and I've played with her several times. And after we went to the bird exhibit at the Berlin Zoo, Ian and I were like, gosh, now we've been looking at talking about birds for a while. I just really want to play Wingspan. So we like made a special trip to a game store to see if there was a copy of Wingspan in English that I could buy and gift to our family there. One person was having a birthday. So that was the excuse. But like, truly, I was in another country and jonesing to play a board game hard enough that I made a special trip to a store that, like, no guarantee they were going to have it in a language that I speak. Anyway, Wingspan, super fun game. I'm not going to describe the mechanics of the game because that's very boring. The thing to know is that it's fun. You got little wooden eggs. You've got hundreds, truly hundreds and hundreds of bird cards. You've got a hand of birds. And each one of the cards has a bird fun fact on it. So if you're looking for a fun, pretty easy to play board game, and also a lot of bird fun facts, Wingspan is a board game that you should try. I know there's also a video game version of it now. Can't vouch for that. Have not played it. Maybe it's good. They're also doing a dragon version, which I think not having bird facts is going to... there's pros and cons to doing a dragon version, but no bird facts is a big con.
What's everyone's favorite bird?
Chickadees.
I asked the teens that I worked with, my go-to icebreaker question was, which bird are you? And my answer was always an emu or a cassowary.
Kakapos are also pretty excellent. I'll take either chickadees or kakapos.
Big are kakapos. This is from the zoo. There was a chart on the wall with like different bird sizes, and they had kakapos, and it was like the size of the toddler. Like, they're huge.
They're pretty big, yeah.
They can't fly.
I knew they couldn't fly, but I also did not imagine them to be like 2 feet tall.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. They're parrots, they're nocturnal, they're quite big, and they can't fly, which is why they're quite endangered.
They're also, like, big targets, apparently. Like, they're chicken-sized, easily.
I am a big fan of shoebills, because I think they look like Muppets. They don't look real in any way.
There was a tawny frog mouse at the zoo, which, similar vibe, does not look real.
Oh, yeah, those ones. I love any bird that looks like a Muppet, honestly.
Yeah, yes.
But then also, the vampire parrot. A-plus parrot.
Favorite bird, I might actually go, I'm changing my answer, I might go with kiwi. Because there are kiwis at the Berlin Zoo, but we could not find them. It was hiding, which was too bad, because I don't know how many other times I'm going to have opportunities to look at kiwis. But I had just like a week where I was looking at a lot of kiwi videos, and they move so weird. It's very much like, what if a bird was a mammal? It looks like, what if a chicken was a rabbit? That's a kiwi.
They also kind of sound like dinosaurs. My partner showed me a little video of a kiwi getting caught in a spotlight, like in the dark, and it stands and it sounds like it's making dinosaur noises, and then it does, like, it runs off, and like you said, it's a really funny motion.
Emus, I don't know if anyone's ever heard the noise that emu makes. There's an emu farm in the town where Ian grew up. I mean, it's not like, it's like a public sort of garden with a bunch of little shops that also has emus. I can't describe it. I think the closest I've gotten is they make a noise that's like you hold a ping pong ball underwater, and the noise it makes when it like bloops back up to the top, that's the noise that emus make.
Oh my God. It's definitely a bird moment. We went to the Museum of Nature a month or two ago, and they had an outdoor exhibit full of owls. So closest I'd ever been to owls. And they also had a bald eagle in there who was, like, enormous. Like, definitely larger than a small child.
I went to Granville Island. Now we're all just telling bird anecdotes. I went to Granville Island a few weeks ago, and there was a person there with a hawk. And I was like, oh, cool, like a person with a hawk who's going to talk about hawk facts or whatever. And I like went over to see, and I overheard her saying that it's not like to educate the public about hawks. The hawk's there because it has a job. The hawk's working. The hawk just hangs out to scare seagulls away so seagulls don't steal people's food. Which is amazing.
I like it. Working hawk. Okay.
I'll stop telling bird anecdotes. Birds are having a cultural moment. You heard it here. Maybe not first, but...
Gordon. The pigeon was called Gordon.
Pretty good.
Very good. Thank you. Needed to know that.
Matthew, I said I was going to stop telling bird anecdotes. I'll stop. We'll save it for after the podcast.
No, just do it now.
Matthew, did I tell you that after you... Matthew lived with me for like 2 weeks before he moved back to the States and was in the habit of giving peanuts to crows. And I do think there was a crow that came around looking for Matthew at one point. Like a few days after he left, there was a crow like on our back porch. And was just sort of waiting.
Your crow friend.
You can always feed it peanuts too.
Yeah. It's easy to make friends with crows.
Sadly, there's not many around here for me to make friends with. So hopefully at some point.
At some point. There's some that are across the street, but unfortunately they're across the busiest street.
And they keep cutting down the trees on our side of the road.
True. Yes. So it's very hard to, like, they tend to hang out behind there's a little strip mall thing across the street from us. And they tend to hang out behind that strip mall near the trash area that's over there. But like the street in between it, us and that, is really busy. So it's not like a convenient thing. You can just go like wander across when you see some and go feed them some peanuts. Like that's not going to work. Okay. So I utterly do not have a transition related to that other than maybe the 10-year-old media thing. If we go back to that one, it's more than 10 years old. So I think I briefly mentioned in December, though it wasn't one of the main media items I talked about, I think I briefly mentioned that I've been playing a lot of Two Point Hospital as a PC game that I was enjoying. And I have continued to play a bunch of that. But I also started to play another game, Terraria, which has been out for ages. I think it came out in like 2011. It is a side-scrolling action sort of game, except it's also like building. It's sort of like if Minecraft, if it was tiny and you were side-scrolling as a little itty-bitty version of yourself, and you could not look like, you could only, you know, see onto that 2D plane that you were walking back and forth, right and left across. You couldn't actually like in Minecraft, you can like look at the eyes of the character, right? You can't do that in this one. But you are built, like you build little houses, you make friends with local characters, you do a lot of mining, and then you can kind of take your own time at it, but there are bosses to fight and kill to progress to different phases of it. Now, I have not played that much of it, and I'm playing it pretty chill and slowly. So, like, I have not beaten the... I'm at the stage where I'm ready to go play the main kind of boss to end the first phase of the game and get into the sort of bigger, broader portions of the game. But I just haven't done all the build-out that I need to do to be ready to fight that boss. So, I've kind of slowed down for a little bit here while my job has gotten a little wild and is actually eating a little bit into my evening time. But I've been having a lot of fun with it. I am not when it comes to playing games, I play a lot of them. I'm not very good at them. My manual dexterity is not good in the realm of playing video games. So I die a lot when I have to fight anything. So I tend to avoid fighting related games because I just die constantly. But one of the aspects of this game is that you're constantly sort of leveling up your gear and you can get it to levels where it makes it a lot easier for you to do that if you're willing to do the grinding process of finding the necessary gear. And I'm willing to, because that's kind of how I play games, is fairly grindy, because I just am not particularly good at doing the fighting stuff. So I just play slow, grindy games that allow me to just take my time and chill through it. And but they have to keep me engaged then, right? So I have to be able to play it that way and still be engaged. And Terraria has been successful at maintaining that balance for me. So I've had a lot of fun with it. I look forward to whatever the next level shall bring to me to see what it's like. I did start it a little bit because the loading ready run show that I sometimes run, that I sometimes watch, called Mine O'Clock, which usually plays Minecraft, is taking a brief break from playing Minecraft all the time. And they're going to try a couple of other games. And one, the first game they decided to try was Terraria. So I watched them play and I was like, you know what? I think maybe that one might actually work for me. Because I did have Terraria. I'd heard about it. I knew of it. I had it on my list of potential things that would work for me, but I wasn't sure. And after I watched them play, but I was like, you know what? I do think that might, the way they're playing and the way things build up, in there, I can see that actually being possible for me to get there. Will I ever actually successfully beat the game? Heck, probably not. But you know what? I beat very few of the games I play, so I don't really care. So that's not the point for me. I'm not that kind of a player. So Terraria, that's been a fun one for me. I've enjoyed it. I'm playing a PC. You can't get it in console now, but I'm probably a PC gamer more than anything, so.
I don't have a transition for this, but I do have an update on my attempt to read long books. I've got three, which, aside from all being fiction, don't seem to have anything else really connecting them. I read The Abominable by Dan Simmons, which was 663 pages. It's kind of like a historical fiction thriller about three climbers who attempt Mount Everest while trying to recover the body of a young man who died on Everest, and so his mother is bankrolling this particular attempt, which takes place in like 1925, I think. And while they're on the mountain, something is chasing them down. It's scary. Maybe that is a link, but it's more thrillery and lots of climbing stuff. So, like, early 20th century climbing without necessarily all the cool gear. The next one is Dead Water by C.A. Fletcher, which is 513, just squeaking in my arbitrary 500-page limit. This one is much more like supernatural horror. It's an island off the coast of Britain, maybe? We're not entirely sure. And a series of unfortunate events causes some supernatural terribleness to start up, and the island's close-knit community is rather devastated, except for the small group of survivors who are desperately trying to figure out a way to defend themselves against supernatural terribleness. And then the third one is The Year of the Locust by Terry Hayes, which is the biggest doorstopper at 760 pages, which is spy book, but like the least propulsive, thrillery spy book I have read in a while. So if you like your spy books slow and measured and full of information, facts, and things, this might be the book for you, except for like the last 150 pages where they're finally like, ah, crap, we have to still save the world dramatically. So far, doing okay on the reading long books.
Update for my reading resolution for the year, which is the opposite of Megan's. I have passed 50 short stories read so far.
Woo-hoo. Are they all in collections or did you read some in like magazines or something?
One was online. But the rest have all been in the too many collections of short stories I have acquired over the last year.
So there'll be a list at the end of the year.
Yep. There are. We'll see. I'm hoping. I made a spreadsheet. Everyone stamped their bingo square.
Yeah. The surprise on our faces.
For how many I need to read each week. to do this. I'm running a little bit behind because I got a late start in this, but I'm catching up. So I think this seems achievable for me. But it's been interesting to just read a bunch of short stories, as it's not something I've really done much in the past.
Neat. I'm looking forward to hearing it, the end of this particular thing and what you find from that experience.
At this point, one of the things it might inspire me to do is to write more myself, because I'm in some cases, I'm like, I can write better than this.
Nice. We are well into this episode. Do we want to do a super speed round where you just everybody gets like 1 minute to mention their last thing if they got three things or whatever?
Oh, sure. I had a rant planned for this one. I'll try to fit into 1 minute.
Yeah.
So my last thing.
If it's 2 minutes, it's fine, Jan. just go for as long.
I'm using Matthew's ceding his minute to me. You can cut out some of my bird stories.
No, those are essential. I've already created a section in the show notes for birds we mentioned.
Love it. Perfect. I just saw it. That's great. So my last thing is Redactyl. This is a game that made my runners-up list on our best of episode last year. It is, as the name might imply, kind of in the style of like Wordle and all those other. It's just a daily game, which is the connection. It's a daily sort of puzzle word game. And what it is they every day have a Wikipedia article and they've redacted all of the words for it, except the most common words and like the prepositions and things. And you guess one word at a time, words that might be in the article until you have filled out enough to try to deduce what the article is. And so my partner, Ian, and I play this every single night. We love it. It is exactly our brand of nerdy. Sometimes it is too hard. The only improvement I would suggest is some kind of hint button or some kind of give up button, because at the moment, if you don't know the answer, like we have gotten ones where we have filled it out enough to know what it is. So it's like, oh, it's a German filmmaker. We've exhausted all of the German filmmakers we know. And so we just are not going to get this one. And you can, you know, try to use whatever sentence segments you have to do a search and find the article. But yeah, it is great fun if you're exactly my kind of nerd.
That very much sounds like something that you and Ian would enjoy doing.
Yes.
Yes. We did one with our family when we were visiting, and just there was a perfect moment where sometimes you'll guess a word just sort of not truly out of left field, but like that seems like a long shot. In this one, birds, it was chickens, because there was like a paragraph mentioning North Carolina and like a number. And I was like, this is going to be about the number of chickens. And guess, and that was correct. The article was industrial farming. And so there were like 10 incidents of the word chickens. It was great. It was a exquisite feeling to like do this sort of long shot, half jokey guess and have it be correct. Anyway, Redactyl's great. It is not perfect. It is a charming sort of in its imperfections. I just wanted to mention it's not an official New York Times puzzle property, but also fuck the New York Times and their puzzles. I'm using this platform right now to say fuck Connections specifically. It drives me wild anytime anyone talks about Connections. It's like their puzzle that has blown up the most since Wordle. And I fucking hate it because it's just only Connect. It's just the game show only Connects. That's all it is. It's like the last round of Only Connect, a game show that's been on TV for 20 years, and they don't mention it anywhere. They don't acknowledge it. It's like, imagine that you were a fan of Jeopardy and you watched Jeopardy for many years and you played like fan versions of Jeopardy on the internet, and then the fucking New York Times made a puzzle app that was just Jeopardy. It was just the Jeopardy board, and they didn't mention that anywhere. And people tweeted at them and were like, hey, this is Jeopardy. And they were like, no, it's not.
Oh, this is 100% Only Connect. It's literally just that.
Yeah, yeah. They released I'll link to an article from Eurogamer where the New York Times released a statement about it. There's a talk section on the Wikipedia page about the New York Times Connections puzzle that there's like a bit of I love Wikipedia talk page drama, but there's some drama about if the article was too focused on comparing it to the Only Connect. But it's just, if you are a fan of Only Connect, like, it's just, It's just so fucking frustrating because people talk about how great the Connections puzzle is, and it'd be fine if they were like, yeah, it's based on Only Connect, but never once is anyone like, yeah, it's based on this game show. Everyone thinks the New York Times came up with it, and they didn't. Way past my 1 minute.
Your Jeopardy one would also, the New York Times would call it Jeopardize and then deny that it was based on Jeopardy.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so the one I'm going to do is, I believe I've also mentioned this creator before. This is a YouTube creator named Amanda the Jedi, who does videos usually between 20 to 35 minutes, depending, that are various media analysis videos, particularly into film. So the majority are either film or TV, like streaming TV shows. Occasionally also does books, particularly books that tie into some ridiculous recent TV show, like a TV version was made or something like that, or a movie version was made of the book, and chooses the really, like, ridiculous ones, the ones that actually sort of punish them to read. but she's almost always makes me laugh out loud. Right? Like, this is just fun and clever, has really engaging persona, is Canadian also, there's that. And I just really enjoy her work as a great way to keep me a little bit updated on what's going on in TV and movies, because I would not know on my own. I do not watch nor seek out information about these on my own, but to do so in a way where I just really enjoy getting a little bit of content from this particular creator, because I love the way that she presents things, how she analyzes things, what she looks at, what kind of focus and perceptions she gives to these materials. If you want to look for a couple that are fairly recent and topical, she did a pretty long and unusually long for her analysis of the fall of the House of Usher, TV series, I guess it is. That was really, like, this is one of her more serious one where she really engages with it and really goes through the tropes and pieces. I will say she is absolutely spoilery. She will tell you everything from this point is a spoiler. So if you really want that media, you might want to go get that experience before you watch her things, because she goes through it. She will tell you all the spoilery things in there. So there's that. Another one, though, that was a lot of fun because it's a little bit more of a piece of media with a lot of issues, but particularly some fun issues to engage with, was explaining the chaotic disaster of Madame Web. So that was sort of a fun one to see her perspective on. She's a big fan of things that are tacky in a fun way, disastrously bad in a fun way, has a lot of affection for the things that other people might consider trash in quotation marks, and particularly looking at what's fun and engaging and why do we get into those things, and how do we find the ones that are really genuinely fun and engaging as opposed to the ones that are genuinely not really good. So that's it. Amanda the Jedi as a YouTube creator.
I'm thrown out there is my speed round, a book called Bungalow Details Interior by Jane Powell. It is a 2006 publication. It is a little bit architectural history of the bungalow as a architectural form and trend, as well as advice about how to refurbish, renovate, bring back up to historical vague accuracy a bungalow. And so for anyone else out there who is also Canadian and understands bungalow as a one-story building house, apparently there is a very specific understanding of bungalow, which is a 1920s to 1940s craftsman style, maybe a little bit of art deco bungalow that came out of the California, basically. And is just very different from my particular understanding of a bungalow. But regardless of the fact that apparently the house that I live in is a bungalow in Canadian terms, but not necessarily in Jane Powell's understanding of a bungalow. I found this book fascinating, both because it has lots of pictures of craftsman-style bungalows and the weird little, like, historical details of how they used to do vernacular architecture in that time period. And now I know the phrase vernacular architecture, so that's fun. So that was just a weird rabbit hole that I fell down, and now I have another series of books about vernacular architecture that I am apparently going to be reading now. Thanks, Jane.
I just looked up bungalow because I'm like, hey, sure, like maybe my understanding of this is wrong as well. To connect back to Jam's Wikipedia thing, I'm very annoyed at Wikipedia as it says a bungalow is a single-story building or house or whatever it is. And then the first image, the very first image, it's a two-story building. And I'm like, no, get this off of this page. Gone.
No, like historically a bungalow was a type of a house that was built in India because you had big wraparound porches because it was hot and airflow and stuff like that. And the British took this style and transferred it over to Britain. And then it actually became popular through the California version. But the way we refer to one-story houses around here, just as straight-up bungalows compared to in Jane Powell's books, there's all kinds of like one-and-a-half, two-story buildings, which she refers to as bungalows. And I am like, no?
They're just houses. It's just a house.
It's just a house.
I was going to say, is there a European, not necessarily European, but international thing happening where, you know, my hotel room on my trip was on the second floor, meaning it was on the third floor.
Clearly, Megan and I are thinking of metric bungalows as opposed to imperial bungalows.
I think that's it. Read the show notes for all the mentions of birds you might be interested in.
Yep. You can find all sorts of fun birds to look at.
Tell us your favorite birds.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we need to add birds to the list of nonfiction topics.
Ornithology.
It is not. It does not specify any specific type of animal, though animals is on the list.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Book Club for Masochists. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, subscribe so you never miss an episode, and consider giving us a positive rating and or review. And if you've already done that, thank you very much.
For all of our URLs and social media accounts, the 4 in our name is the numeral. You can go to our website at bookclub4m.com. Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/bookclub4m. And find us on Instagram at bookclub4m. We also have a Discord server. You can join it. Find that link in the show notes. If you want to email us, the address to email is bookclub4m@gmail.com.
On our website, you can find show notes that will provide links to things that we mentioned, some of the social media info for people who appeared on this podcast, and our genre-based book lists of titles by authors of color.
You can suggest a genre or title for us to read, or you can request a recommendation from us. We have a form you can fill out on our website to request things. Yes, no promises on reading your suggestion, but we will give you a recommendation if you ask for one.
All opinions are our own and do not reflect our places of employment, if they exist.
Book Club for Masochists is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 4.0 International License.
Our theme music is To Arrakis by Dark Sun from the Free Music Archive.
New episodes of the first and some third Tuesdays of every month.
Join us again on Tuesday, May 7th, when we will be discussing books from indie publishers.
Then on Tuesday, June 4th, we'll be discussing nonfiction about pop culture.
Matthew, you need to move where you put the new if it exists, because it sounds like the podcast episode itself may not exist, not the social media may not exist.
Oh, I was hoping it was if the people, the host, may or may not exist.
Yeah, the social media might not exist, potentially implied here. But yeah, it says social media info for everyone who appeared on this episode, if it exists.
Yeah, okay. That's fine.
The episode you've just listened to might or might not exist.
That's the qualifier for the whole show. If it exists.
Let's try not to gaslight our listeners.
Yeah, that's true. That seems unkind.
We have a whole episode where we all talk about books that don't exist.
Oh, that'd be so good.
We all bring fake books and review them.
Yes,
and people just like are like, I cannot find this anywhere.
We should harvest from our own list of all the book recommendations we made for like potential books. You should try writing this. You should try writing that, because we have recommended a lot over the years.
It's true.
Okay, we got to stop making our bad plans on mic.
But then I can put, them into the outro.
My name is Jam. I'm a librarian in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is located on the traditional. I'm going to start again because I definitely clanked my fork against my bowl while I was saying that.
Oh no, frozen jam.
Frozen jam does not sound very appealing.
No, that's
that sounds like a very upset morning exclamation.